Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical...
sort of.
...podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we will answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
We have one of my old buddies coming in today to talk to us.
From medical school?
From medical school. His name is Bobby Davari. He is a doctor who is now in Southern California.
He's very interested in alcohol abuse.
That's right. And why we're under-treating it and how we can do better about treating it.
The opinions on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. We're here with Bobby Davari, family medicine doctor. He is the chair of pharmacy and therapeutics at Kaiser Orange County. Bobby, welcome to the show, buddy.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. I've been looking forward to this.
Thanks for coming.
I'm a huge fan.
Full disclosure, Bobby is also a very good friend of mine. I've known him since medical school, so...
I didn't know that.
It might get weird.
Yeah, we go way back.
I feel a little left out. Should I leave?
Yeah, for just like 5 minutes.
Okay, we're going to take a pause. Just kidding. We're not. We're on a strict clock.
So, actually, there's so much to talk about, but there actually is some like real like medical business for us to discuss. Hmm. And that is, in particular, your interest in sort of shifting the paradigm of alcohol abuse treatment. So, before we talk about that, can you give us a little background on alcohol abuse in the United States?
Yeah, so I think the data out there is pretty clear now that we're seeing usage of alcohol at levels that we had never seen before, and the death rates from cirrhosis increasing. Just a recent study that just came out showing that there's a 65% increase deaths from cirrhosis just recently.
So cirrhosis for our listeners.
Yeah, liver failure from alcohol use.
Yeah, that Kaveh and I as GI liver doctor see.
Yeah,
probably every day cirrhosis and alcohol abuse, and it's clearly on the rise.
Right, and what we know now is that there's about 1 in 10 Americans die every year from alcohol use, whether it's from the medical side or from trauma or accidents and so on. So it's the number three most preventable cause of death in the United States, number one being obesity, then smoking, and then alcohol. So it's up there.
Let me ask you, is that all alcohol use, like people like just in getting drunk if they're not necessarily chronic abusers of alcohol? Or are we talking specifically about people who chronically abuse alcohol?
I think it's just all comers. So all mortality related to alcohol is 1 in 10
Americans. Include accidents in there. It could be honestly just a healthy person who got murdered.
Right. Or 16-year-old that first time drinking ever, you know, drank too much and drove. So from that all the way on up. So there's some estimates now I saw recently around 40% of our patients in the hospital have an alcohol use disorder.
And how do you define that?
Good question. So there's strict sort of criteria for it. There's a diagnostic and statistical manual that our psychiatric colleagues put out that sort of tell us what you know, sort of criteria you have to meet. And your doctor could go over that with you. But generally, I define it as the three C's, which is compulsive use, inability to cut down, and then continued use despite harm. So I think for listeners, like, how do I know if I have an alcohol use disorder? And you'll notice I use alcohol use disorder instead of saying, how do I know if I'm an alcoholic? I think that's one of the main things, I think a take home, if you remember nothing else from this talk or from this conversation, is to remember that that's the big change right now, is we've moved away from labeling people as either alcoholic or not an alcoholic. There's really a spectrum between unhealthy alcohol use, no alcohol use disorder, unhealthy alcohol use, mild, moderate, and then severe.
That's a great point. I think there's a lot of people who could easily convince themselves, I'm not an alcoholic. And with most of our definitions are probably right, but they may have abused alcohol and they may not be using it the right way, obviously. So that's an interesting paradigm shift right there.
Do you ever use like the CDC guidelines? Because I'll say to my patients, you know, really for women, maybe one drink a day. Mm-hmm. And patients often don't know that one regular size, like 12-ounce beer equals one 3-ounce glass of wine equals one shot of hard liquor. You know, patients sometimes think, you know, oh, I'm just drinking wine, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And they don't realize that mm-hmm. the alcohol content in what is considered one dose or one drink is the same, no matter how that vessel is consumed.
Yeah, I think the real take home is making sure that you check with somebody else. If you think that you might have an alcohol use disorder, you talk with your doctor. I mean, I think that would be a great advice. I wouldn't talk to your friends, because usually you surround yourself with friends that have similar vices. So it's like, you know, it's like, do I have a golfing problem or a surfing problem? Yeah. But if I ask my friends, they probably surf or golf more than I do, or, you know, play volleyball more than I do.
So Orange County.
I know, right?
Golfing.
I know.
We have to stop a golfing disease.
I know, right?
Yeah, we do. Awful. It's a problem. It is a problem.
It's very addictive.
So we also in the office, I'll ask patients, not how much do you drink? Because they'll say occasionally, moderately, zero. I'll say specifically, in a week, how many drinks do you have? And if they won't commit, I'll say, okay, in a month. Like I really try to make people think about, you know, something more concrete than just small, medium, and large. Right. You know, it just is not applicable.
What are the current screening recommendations, and what are the current sort of treatment strategies?
So if you want to sort of define what a primary care doc does, or a family practice doc does, we're like the experts or the specialists in screening. So in sort of deciding, so who needs to be screened for what and how often.
For preventative healthcare, yeah.
Exactly. For preventive healthcare is sort of my area of expertise. And so we really go by the recommendations of the United States Preventative Services Task Force. And they recommend annual screening for alcohol use disorder. Why? Well, because they show that doing that actually helps us make the diagnosis and then helps us to treat. Is we use a one question questionnaire, which has been validated.
I like where you're going.
So the one question, because it's much faster and just as effective and more effective really, is have you ever in the last 12 months, have you had more than 4 drinks in one sitting if you're a woman, or 5 if you're a man? If you have, then that should alert the doctor to continue to ask you more questions to see if you have an alcohol use disorder.
So it's an interesting screening question.
Just one question.
It doesn't rule in alcohol abuse disorder, mm-hmm. but at least alerts you to that right. There may be like a what percentage chance that this person does have.
So we use sort of sensitivity specificity numbers. It's about 80% chance that you're somewhere on the spectrum. So if your listeners out there, if I ask you, hey, if you're a woman, more than 4 drinks in one sitting in the last year, you guys are looking at each other. So I think I saw you have 5 last night. Anyway, so the point is that, you know, that just should sort of spur you to sort of be curious and investigate whether or not you have a use disorder and where you are on the spectrum. It's actually really easy to do. You could do a Google search for the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual criteria for alcohol use disorder. It's 11 questions. Ask yourself those questions. If you have 4 or more, or 3 or 2 or 3 of those questions are positive, you have a mild disorder. If 4 or 5 are positive, you have moderate. And if you have 6 or more, you have a severe alcohol use disorder. Now, here's the deal. Here's the big issue. The big issue is that, and this is something that I've been working on in Kaiser, is that roughly, there's around 15% of the U.S. population that fall somewhere on the moderate to severe spectrum, which is crazy because that's a lot of people. We have about 5 million patients in Southern California. And so if you think about 15% of those patients have an alcohol use disorder, we're talking a lot of people.
Wait, so, aren't you actually surprised it's not a higher percentage?
So I'm talking moderate to severe. So somewhere on the spectrum, it's probably
everyone's
closer to
30%. Everyone's got mild, moderate, or severe.
Yeah, somewhere on the spectrum. It's probably 30% is a little bit higher number, but moderate to severe. Now, what's interesting to me about that number is that it's about the same amount of people have, same percentage of people have diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And what's interesting to me, and the reason I'm here to talk to you all, is because our diabetics, I love you guys, but our diabetics, 100% of our diabetics, or nearly 100% of our diabetics, are offered medications to treat their diabetes. But our patients with alcohol use disorder, less than 10% of them, I think the numbers are 5%, are ever offered medications to help with treatment. And we have very effective medications for treatment. And that's something that's really not well known in the general public or even amongst doctors.
So before we talk about the treatment strategy that you're mentioning, let me just first ask, you know, if we really do believe, we've talked about abuse of drugs and alcohol a little bit on the show before, but if we really do believe that alcohol abuse is a disease, why don't we treat it as such? Why do people treat diabetes and alcohol abuse so differently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have a good answer. There's multiple reasons. One, I think there's a lot of stigma associated with it. And I think part of it comes from our language around sort of labeling people as alcoholic or not alcoholic. I remember the old adage back when we were training, it was like, how do you know if the patient's an alcoholic? Well, if he drinks more than his doctor, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, so I think, and what you see in fact is alcohol use disorder actually affects people that are very motivated actually to a larger degree. Because, you know, if you're going to be really good at studying and getting straight A's, you're also going to be really good at drinking and sort of drinking mm-hmm. more. You're going to be better at drinking than anybody else, dang it, right?
Your ambition goes to all facets of life.
Right.
I think another thing, I mean, there's clearly stigma. Although if diabetes, you're saying maybe type 2 is associated with obesity, we know there's a ton of stigma with that. But I think that a big difference for me, having trained in just general medicine and obviously now not really practicing it, is, you know, with diabetes, there's a number that you're following. You're following the sugars, you're following the hemoglobin A1C. With alcohol, like, what is your endpoint? Like, you know, it's not like one pill and one sugar level and you have success. The measurement of success or failure is much harder, I think, with alcohol, substance abuse stuff. And it's really, you know, we'll get into it, but it's not just like start a pill and okay, we'll just check, come back in 3 months. It's not like that. It's not as sort of quote unquote easy.
Right. And I think that turns doctors off because
right.
we really like to be, outcome driven.
Right.
And we like to see closure. Like I gave this antibiotic and the infection went away.
Right.
And now I feel like I did something and I did something good. And I'm trying to really change that narrative because I don't think that serves our patients really well.
It's very interesting. It is treating a disease as opposed to a person, which is, again, the concept of narrative medicine. We had Emily Silverman on. We talked about it. And it is, again, treating the circumstances and the human and not just a number, not just a disease, which is hard for us because that's what we're better at. So,
right, exactly.
So the treatment strategies for alcohol, you know, traditionally we just say stop, right? Like when people are really, especially again, Kaveh and I, we see cirrhotics, which is scarred down, not really working livers. We would say, please stop 100% of all alcohol intake. So you as a family practice doctor and having done a lot of, you know, work in this, what is the treatment strategy that you would take? And is there a step-by-step approach or just sort of a general kind of shotgun?
These medications are getting to the point where they're so effective that if you don't use them or at least offer them to patients, it's like, you know, you really are behind the times. And I'll tell you, the way that we were doing this before is you would say, first of all, doctors really were not screening patients for alcohol use disorder generally in primary care. It really wasn't happening. And where it was happening, it was like, you know, try to cut down, you know, if you have a problem, if you want help, let me know, come back.
Or you refer them to like an addiction specialist.
Or you go, you know what, if you want, here's a phone number, go see the addiction medicine specialist. But here's the problem with that approach. Let me just, the problem with that approach is that most people have jobs and they can't go see, they can't take time off to go see that. They can barely take time off to come see me as their primary care doc.
Right.
So then we're saying, A, you have to buy into this fact that you have a problem. B, you have to go see another specialist who then will see you at some point in the future.
Right.
And at that point in the future, maybe you have motivation to quit or maybe you don't at that point. You lose the motivation to do it at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to pay another copay
right.
to go do that. And as you all know, I mean, that's a lot to ask.
The more barriers you put in place, the less likely they are to follow through.
It's a lot of barriers.
So money, appointment, time.
That's right. So to bring it back to the diabetes analogy, it would be like diagnosing someone with diabetes and then saying to every one of them, you need to see an endocrinologist to get treatment. I will not give you your insulin or your metformin or any of your medications until you see the endocrinologist.
Which is a specialist in diabetes and hormones in general. And that's, again, another appointment. And primary care doctors need to be equipped with certain basic skills of treatment of very common diseases like diabetes, like alcohol use disorder.
So you're sort of arguing that the paradigm shift here has to be, instead of this going out to a specialist, instead of this being pushed off to a later date, to address it right there at that point of contact with that patient when you're there. As a family practice doctor, as an outpatient doctor, are you meeting resistance with this?
Right. So it's such a paradigm shift, I think, for now. To be fair, primary care docs, the average number of complaints we deal with in one visit is around 3, 2 to 3 complaints. We almost never get someone that comes in and says, hey, I just have this knee problem. Can you fix it? And can you help me? It's always, I have this problem plus these 3 other things. Now, and that's gotten a little bit worse with time because people get busier. Money is still tight for most people. In fact, I think the latest data I saw, most Americans can't come up with $2,000. That means not only do they not have $2,000, but no one they know has that much money to help them out. So if their car breaks down and they need to fix their car, they wouldn't be able to come up with that kind of cash. A lot of people in the U.S., majority of people, 50% or more, are living paycheck to paycheck. So I don't assume any of my patients are independently wealthy and they have unlimited funds. I assume that they're going to have some trouble. And so I just try to help them out with as many problems as I can. But the point is, most primary care doctors are under the gun to take care of as many problems as they can in one visit.
So you're saying instead of stopping, instead of just saying cut back, harm reduction, if mm-hmm. you will, like just, you know, this is, I'm identifying this problem. You know, a lot of people don't know that there is medication. So what is that? You know, how do we get that word out and what's the strategy to start it?
Right. So I think that the area that I've really been pushing on with Kaiser, and I have to sort of give credit to our sort of leaders in Kaiser for seeing the value of that and looking at the data and being really open to the data with me and said, oh my gosh, you know, these medications work to help people reduce their drinking. The problem is that the medication that was sort of held up as the treatment for alcohol use disorder is antabuse or disulfiram. And that's not an effective medication. That makes you sick if you drink. So if you have trouble with alcohol and you want to drink, you just stop that medication.
Right.
And then you go back to drinking.
But what it is negative conditioning.
Right.
So if you drink alcohol, you feel like garbage, you get red and flushed and hot and bothered and you don't want to drink anymore. But it's really an awful, it's like sort of slapping someone.
Yeah, it's just not an effective way to, and it's been disproven. Not only that, it's actually dangerous. So if you have someone, for example, that's a diabetic or they're an epileptic or they have other medical conditions where if they were to get violently ill and vomit, right, they could stroke out or their blood pressure goes up and they could have a heart attack while they're vomiting. So it's just not something we would want our primary care doctors to do. And it's really been debunked as a treatment modality for treating alcohol use disorder. So, but we have good medicines now that have actually been around for a long time now. It's been around over 10 years, almost 15 years now. It reduces your drinking by about 80%, your heavy drinking, the medication. The medication is called naltrexone. There's another medication called acamprosate, which is about equally effective.
So, and they block cravings, right?
So they do to a degree. So acamprosate is thought to block cravings. Naltrexone disrupts the pleasure pathway in the brain. So it's an opiate blocker. So it actually blocks your brain naturally produces what we call endorphins. And so what it does is it blocks the endorphin release that's thought to sort of be the pathway that your brain takes to make you addicted to things. And so if you take the medicine and you continue to drink, you don't form those same addictive pathways in your brain. And so it seems to disrupt that pathway. And what we find, and I've been doing this now for a few years where I've been treating patients with the medication, what they'll tell me is that they sort of just lose interest in the alcohol slowly over time. It's not something that they sort of obsessively think about or like want to keep going. They still can have a drink. And that's my second point. My first point was that people can't afford to go see another specialist. It's expensive. The second point is that a lot of people, you can't expect them to completely change their lifestyle, right? It's a big ask for people, A, to spend a lot of money to go see a specialist over, you know, several visits, and then to, you know, talk about all their problems with a therapist or whatever. That's a lot to expect from someone that's busy working, supporting a family. And then it's also a big thing to ask someone to completely change all their friendships, where they go to have fun, how they relax. It's a really big ask for patients. So let me touch,
this kind of go back on two things here. One, you kind of mentioned the data that shows its efficacy. Could you touch on that a little bit more? Can you tell me what's the percentage improvement we're seeing here? You were about to go into numbers needed to treat. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. One of my roles at Kaiser is I chair the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. And one of my roles there is to look at how good medications are and whether or not we want to, as a group of physicians, begin using that drug to help our patients. And we have a dedicated team of pharmacists. They're called evidence pharmacists, and they look at these medications to help us decide whether or not we want to really begin using those medications. And so I've been watching this medication, naltrexone and nicamprosate. I've had my eye on it for about 12 years now. I'm just waiting for the data to accumulate. And there's this group called the Cochrane reviewers or Cochrane database, where they combine all the trials over a long period of time. And I've been waiting for them to sort of do this sort of review, and they've done it, and they've combined all these trials, and they came up with a number needed to treat of 10, which in medical parlance is a really good number. That's like a really effective drug in terms of for treatment. So just to put it in perspective, if you go to see your doctor for a sinus infection, the number needed to treat for a sinus infection is around 12. So if you think about it, if you go to a doctor with a sinus infection and he gives you antibiotics, you go, oh, he's doing a good job. But it's actually less effective than the drug that we use to treat alcohol use disorder.
For people who don't know what number needed to treat means, that means basically you would have to treat 10 people
right.
to get the benefit.
Right.
Which you might say, why isn't it a number needed to treat one?
Why
can't everybody? That's just not how medicine works, unfortunately. Most medicine doesn't work for everybody all the time. So the number needed to treat 10 here is not bad.
It's really good, yeah.
What are the downsides of the medications, and is everybody a candidate to start it? Like, what are the risks?
That's a great question. So the research figure we use for that is called the number needed to harm. How many people do you need to put on the medication to harm one person? And interestingly, for antibiotics for sinusitis, the number is 8. So that's not good. You want the number to be really high. We don't have those figures for these medications, only because the harms are not really there. Their liver function test might be elevated. Some people get nausea, but I don't have clear data on that. It's probably around 50 or 100. The continued heavy use of alcohol is a daily drug use. It's using a medication to help sort of reduce that daily drug use is really, I think, a key point to make, because we now know that these increases in sort of death from cirrhosis related to alcohol is is really at epidemic proportions. And so the medications, every medication has side effects, and naltrexone, the main one would probably be nausea, some upset stomach. I would say similar to, side effects you would get from antidepressants, some nausea, upset stomach kind of stuff, but nothing, severe. The effort we've been making it, in my area in Southern California and Kaiser is to empower primary care doctors to begin discussing it earlier with their patients, start helping their patients to sort of make the diagnosis without judgment, mm-hmm. and just to say, hey, look, this is where you are on the spectrum. You have a mild use disorder right now based on the criteria. And we reviewed the criteria with them and go, look, you meet 3 out of the 11 criteria. You have a mild use disorder. And that's just where you're at. We can check it again in a year and see if it's gotten worse, better, or the same. And I think similar to diabetes, you don't call the patient and go, oh, your A1C or your blood sugars are up. You disgust me. Like, we don't do that. Like, that'd be silly to do, And so we shouldn't be doing that with people that drink alcohol. And similarly, what I think the drugs, the medications do is that it gives the doctors a ticket to talk to the patients about their use at the next visit.
Sounds like the medications are effective. Mm-hmm. The naltrexone sounds like it works pretty well. I mean, I'm assuming you can't use it if someone's taking opiates for pain or something
Correct.
Else, but it sounds like they work pretty well. Mm-hmm. Not that much in terms of side effects. Are you getting resistance to this? Are people accepting this? Because you, just like you said, these family practice doctors, right. these outpatient doctors are being slammed. Right. Is this something that people are receiving well?
Yeah, I'll tell you, there's a lot of people in leadership that were worried that the family docs would be overwhelmed, because, again, we just deal with a lot of problems in one visit, and I haven't seen a lot of that. A lot of the family docs are really happy to be able to help and have another tool in their tool belt to help folks. Because this, more seasoned clinicians don't find it overwhelming, but they really do find it like really helpful to have another thing they can help patients with. And one of the neat things about being a primary care doctor is you have a big picture view. So I'll see someone that comes to see me with obesity, and they're obese, and that maybe is the source of their high blood pressure. But then if you take one more step back, you go, where did the obesity come from? Well, every time they have 2 or 3 beers, they eat about 30% more food. And that's been shown in studies that if you drink, you eat about 15 to 30% more because you lose that perception of being full. Mm. And so then if you take a step back, you go, well, hold on a second. You're drinking, 2 or 3 beers a day. Maybe that's the root of the problem. And so to ask that person to go exercise is, I guess, great. But now they're working out an hour a day, but they're still drinking 2 to 3 beers a day and eating 15 to 30% more than they used to, there's no amount of exercise they're going to be able to do to counteract the root of the problem, which is the alcohol.
Right.
Now, the alcohol isn't the root of every problem, but if you don't address it, you're just missing a piece. And I've found that a lot of primary care doctors are really excited to have an ability to sort of engage this issue. And in fact, our national organization, the American Academy of Family Physicians, is now really endorsing the use of these medications within primary care.
So you said that, you've been sort of keeping your eye on the naltrexone mm-hmm. and for over a decade. But clearly this is an interest. How did, is this something that you're always interested in, addiction medicine, or is there something else that sort of inspired you to pursue this?
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look back, we all probably have some people we know in our families or friends that have struggled with alcohol use disorder. I know in medical school.
Or any addiction,
mm-hmm. but specifically alcohol, it's just ubiquitous. But I had friends in medical school and college that sort of struggled with alcohol use disorder. And then I have, I would say, at least 7 family members, aunts and uncles, and my own father that sort of struggled with alcohol use problems for years and years. So I kind of saw it growing up. And so for me, it was always one of those things where I saw people struggle with it and then not really be able to take the time out. Just a personal example with my father, he was a fighter pilot. He'd been a POW. He'd survived torture And, you know, he was able to sort of deal with all that and sort of come, you know, and be successful in this country. But then the alcohol, he still struggled with alcohol. And so to my mind, I was like, you know, if this guy being so strong and being so amazing at, you know, everything else to then struggle with this thing, it was just mind blowing to me. Even as a kid, I thought, how is it possible that, you know, my hero can't sort of kick this thing? It was always sort of, to me, very puzzling. And so I think that always stuck with me. So I wanted to sort of see if there was a way that I could fix it. And I would have these conversations with patients, but it's really not an easy thing to just, addiction's way bigger than just saying, oh, just quit. You know, it's much harder.
It's interesting though, that you had that perspective. And I think that's sort of the healthy one to have, which is instead of being angry or disgusted with people with addiction, you empathize because you recognize that, you know, this is someone who can be really strong in almost every other aspect of life, but there's something about this particular problem that can get you, even if you're the strongest person.
Well, do you think he was, coping with PTSD? Like, that's a lot of trauma to go through, if he was tortured.
Sure. And at, you know, in those times, you know, in the 70s and 80s, it's not like we really even made that diagnosis.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't really recognized as an issue. And so I think that, you dealt with things the way you could, with what tools you had, and alcohol was the tool.
I mean, even now I do. And, you know, that's why I asked about how do we prevent even having this conversation. I think we all know people use alcohol as stress relief, anxiety relief, to forget your problems. And, you know, there's more that can be done than just reaching for a beer at the end of a hard day, but that's easy. You know, and it's not going away anytime soon. So we're probably going to see more and more of this.
Well, what's funny to me is how glorified it is in media, and how normalized its heavy use is in the media. So if you look at, for example, like popular media, like movies and shows, you know, it's like you. You know, you get the job, you go and celebrate at the bar, right? You get the girl, you meet the girl at the bar, and you guys sort of meet at the bar and you have drinks at the bar, and that's how you get the girl. Or she dumps you, and where do you go? You know, you lose your job, where do you go? To the bar, and you drink. So it's like every roads lead to the bar. So
right.
And not that there's anything wrong with, you know, going and having a drink at the bar, it's fine. But I think that it's really one of those things that is just so popular that it's the first thing people think of when they have a negative emotion. It's like that's, or a positive emotion. It's funny. It's either side.
Let's have a drink to celebrate.
It is funny because it's popular, but it is also, and it's glamorized, but it's also the opposite. I mean, you think of like The Hangover and all these movies you can think of right away. It's like the worst. People wake up and they have no idea who's next to them. Like that is, and vomiting. Like that is actually shown, you know?
You know what? You're right. But at the same time, it's silly. Is sort of glamorized. Like, I got so wasted last weekend. I didn't know about it. Like that's something to be kind of proud of almost, you know?
I know.
And like people are almost proud of that aspect of getting so blitzed that they have a hangover-like experience.
Yeah.
They almost kind of want that in a way now.
Well, I just remember when I was in college, I felt an expectation to have those experiences, like those hangover experiences where you're out and you're making some big mistakes, you know, and you could blame it on the alcohol, you know, and just do those things.
There's a song.
Yeah, I've heard. But you know, there's this. It's just. It's funny that it's really in the. It's in the culture.
It is our culture. Yeah.
It's funny because when you talk to people that have a really severe addiction issue, they don't wear it as a badge of honor. They understand that they have an issue and they're dying to quit. They would love to stop. And they will tell you, I really wish I could stop doing this. And I try and I can't, and I keep trying and I can't. A lot of them have tried several times and they can't do it. And my father was no exception, and he really made sure that me and my brother sort of knew that there was no glamour in it, and that it was not something that he was proud of, and that he was like, he passed that on to us to say, you know, don't do this. This is stupid. I shouldn't do it. And sort of passed that on. And I thought that was a real gift, because neither me or my brother really, you know, we never really drank ever. So kind of kept us out of doing that. Now I have my other issues with, you know, sports. I play too much, but I have that, I feel that sort of, I have that addictive personality.
Humble brag. Yeah. Did you hear that? Totally. I'm totally addicted to being great. That's my problem. I'm addicted to working out.
That was a humble brag.
Right.
No, that is an interesting background that you have in that. Has this treatment, or studying this treatment, has this affected your relationship with your dad? Are you like, have you talked to him about this?
Yeah. So, I think that the interesting thing for me is that the treatment, that you having a medication, makes it more objective. You could just say, hey, you know, how's it going on the medicine?
Yeah.
It's a little different than being like, hey, you know, are you drinking again?
Why haven't you quit yet?
Why haven't you quit?
Right. You can say, how's the medicine is much better than the, because I have patients who will say their labs aren't great. And I'll say, are you drinking? And I always ask, but I know it's such a charged question, because if the answer is no, they feel like I'm accusing them. And if the answer is yes, they feel shame. And it's sort of a lose-lose, but it's totally our job to ask. I ask 100% of the time. It's just always awkward. 100% of the time, awkward.
This is amazing stuff. I had no idea these medications existed. Does it work for anything other than alcoholism, other addictions in general? Or has that been tried yet at all?
It has. To your point, yes, it can. This same medication can be used for, they're using it for actually opiate use disorder too. But it actually has just got FDA approved as an active ingredient in the medication Contrave, which is a weight loss medication. Mm-hmm. So,
because it's blocking those, the
craving.
Pleasure pathways.
Yeah.
That
right.
You get. Yeah.
So it's bupropion plus naltrexone are the two active ingredients in Contrave, that then is now being sold as a weight loss medication.
So the hope is that it's not medication that'll make you sick if you
Correct.
Eat like that disulfiram medication you talked about in the beginning
Correct.
Or antabuse,
right.
But instead it just makes you crave it less.
Correct.
Sounds like this medicine would be good for obesity, alcohol, and opiate addiction. It sounds like all addictions.
Right.
So
do people get addicted to those?
What's it,
to the medicine?
I don't think that's really not, remember the medication sort of blocks the chemical in your brain that produces addiction. So it's almost like a double negative. It's almost like,
but if you're blocking those pleasure pathways, mm-hmm. are people who take these medications having like any sort of depression, or are they having like anhedonia, which means just not like finding joy in life?
Yeah. So I think this is a good point. So, for patients that are struggling with dual diagnoses, meaning that they have severe psychological or psychiatric problems like major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, any of those things, plus an alcohol use disorder or drug use disorder, you know, those patients really do need to be under the care of a psychiatrist. I think we should really take a time out and make sure I make that point very clear. They're very complicated. We have specialists for that reason. Those people become very complicated. So my big problem is that less than 5 or 10% of these patients that have alcohol use disorder are ever even offered the medication.
Right. Anyone can do it. We can do it, you know.
I mean, so. I would love it if someday, and I monitor this on a regional level, like me, I monitor 5 million patients and see what they're getting. I would love to see one day a podiatrist order naltrexone for alcohol. I would just love that.
Well, what a
and
dream.
It sounds, right?
That's like God, that would be like, dream.
I would celebrate with a non-alcoholic beverage.
More likely you're going to end up going out for a drink with your podiatrist.
Oh, that's how it starts.
I would have a club soda.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring that up is because trauma, a lot of trauma comes from drinking too much.
Foot trauma specifically.
But
are you serious?
Any orthopedic trauma, a lot of like, I don't know what the percentage
stubbing
is, but
toe,
a significant amount.
Say,
falling.
Yeah. Broken toes I've heard of.
Well, good luck moving this forward. I think this is an exciting new treatment strategy that you're working on. It's great that you're doing it. It's so, like you said, ubiquitous, and it's one of the top three causes of mortality, like you mentioned. It's kind of almost silly that we're not trying to create newer treatment strategies. So it's great that you're doing this. Thank you for that. Thanks for coming on the show. Next time, maybe we'll talk more about our med school experiences. I'm glad we got the business out of the way this time.
I was like, next time we're going to bring a podiatrist on to counterpoint.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you so much for coming. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Bob. That was great.
Thanks for listening. Please keep the emails and phone calls coming. Email us at hopquestions@gmail.com. Call us at 408-444-6623. And make sure to like us on Facebook, review us on iTunes, and tell your friends to listen.
All antidotes and patient-related details have been changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.